how do you perceive the role of employee constituency groups, i.e. civil service, administrative professionals, faculty senate, graduate council, et cetera, in policy development and implementation and decision making?
Okay, that's quite a question. So let me talk a little bit about my experience in that realm first. So at Ohio University, I work very closely in my current role with Faculty Senate. So I meet with the Executive Committee of Faculty Senate before every meeting, and I attend all of the Faculty Senate meetings because my primary responsibility as provost is working with Faculty Senate. But I also meet with the executive staff, the executive committee of the Administrative Senate and the Classified Senate, and the president and I meet one-on-one with the Student Senate president and the Graduate Student Senate. So we are working with all of the constitutive groups on campus to talk about various issues that are coming up and doing problem solving on each one of those issues. Most of my issues are with Faculty Senate. So let me talk about issues around policies. One of the things that we do on with the Faculty Senate is that they are working on issues and writing resolutions around those issues. Before I came to Ohio University, there had been, I'm trying to think of a tactful way of saying this, there had been a fairly contentious relationship between the previous provost and the Faculty Senate. And in fact, at Ohio University, when a resolution is passed by the Faculty Senate, the provost has to sign or not sign a resolution passed by the Faculty Senate. And they had started to keep a batting average of how many she would sign. And I felt like that was not a very productive relationship. And so what I proposed to the Faculty Senate was that it might be useful for us to work together so that there would be more resolutions that could be signed and we could get policies moving forward more productively. And so we would meet more frequently in order to try to move those policies forward. Let me give you a specific example. One of the things that we worked on last year was Group 2. For us, these are non-tenure track faculty. And we put together some very, very productive policies on ranks for Group 2 faculty members and multi-year contracts for Group 2 faculty members. And collaboratively, we put together policies that could be passed that I could sign, the deans were very supportive of, and that could be moved through the process. In the past, I'm not sure that could have happened, but I was more interested in trying to work together as opposed to having some sort of adversarial relationship. And we have done the same thing on other issues. Classified Senate brought to us an idea for parental leave, and we put together a committee, and we're able to put together a policy that we now have a pilot parental leave policy that we are testing. As a result of an idea that they brought forward. So that's been the way in which we worked on both policy and implementation. And those are some specific examples that I think illustrate both my style and the way in which we'd be able to move policies forward.
Good morning. My question is, in terms of ensuring student voices are heard, we just heard about meeting with the Student Senate, but are there any other steps that you've taken at your current or former institutions to have students' views taken into consideration as part of the campus decision-making process?
Sure. So here's another example. I was asked by the Student Senate to do what's called Pizza with the Provost. This is a great event. It's an open event where both student senators and other students who were interested in topics could come out and talk about any issues that they had. One of the issues that really emerged pretty strongly from the Pizza with the Provost session was that there was advising that was good in some departments, but in other departments was not as good, and that we needed to improve advising in some areas of the campus. And based on that feedback, last year in the budget cycle, I requested out of my office funds to hire professional advisors that could be embedded in the colleges. So centrally, we hired them, we trained them, we continue to provide them with professional development, but we embedded them in the colleges, and we are now using those professional advisors to do a lot more of the proactive advising that I mentioned in my presentation. But that came from comments from students about how they wanted more advising, and we're getting very positive feedback from students as a result of that initiative.
Thank you. Turning to financial matters. Budget cuts from the state and other budget reductions have cut many functions at the university to the core. Fewer and fewer people are performing more and more tasks essential to the operations of their units. The prospect of future reductions would almost certainly spell disaster for many of these units. How would you lead the university through the process of additional budget adjustments that require a prioritization of needs and services while ensuring the university continues to provide a quality education and opportunities for success to our students?
Unfortunately, I have experience with this. So when I came to Ohio University, we also, this was during the recession period, and we also faced budget cuts from the state. It's not unusual that we've been through these budget cutting periods. And so I want to talk a little bit about how we handled that budget cutting process. I think it will give you some sense of the way in which I would want to address these kinds of issues. So my first year, we had to cut $11 million out of the budget in a fairly short period of time. And one of the things that we did is we talked about a set of budget principles that we could agree upon, and we vetted those budget principles out to the campus. And one of the budget principles was that the academic core needed to be protected as much as possible. Not that they could be protected entirely, because with a cut of that size, and I know it doesn't even look like the cut that you're now facing, but at the time, $11 million seemed pretty ominous. All of the units were asked to prepare scenarios. They prepared 5% scenarios, they prepared 10% scenarios, and they all were asked what were the things that they thought that they could do that would have the least effect on students. And they each prepared those scenarios going forward. And so that was the academic units, they were included the non-academic units, and we prepared all of that information. It all went into spreadsheets that we shared with the entire campus, not by names, because you know some of this affected positions, but by kinds of functional areas. And then we put that out for public comment. We had open forums, we talked about those issues. One of the things I said to my president at the time is that I thought we needed to discuss it on campus. And his initial reaction was, are you crazy? You know, this is not the way we should do this. And I said, yes, I really think it's important. I think that this is these are difficult decisions. These are very difficult trade-offs that we're facing. But the campus needs to understand what we're grappling with and needs to understand the kinds of decisions that need to be made going forward and needs to understand how we're trying to handle this situation. And they need to be a party to this conversation. And so we did that. And I will tell you, at the end of that process, one of the comments that we got back from several people was, I don't like some of the decisions that ended up getting made, but I really like the process. I really like that there was a lot of feedback, there was a lot of discussion about this going forward. And I have to tell you, I think that's very important. It's very important to be transparent. It's very important for people to know all along the line exactly what's happening. And I would think that would be very important here, too. So in the end, what we ended up doing was freezing positions as we tried to figure out where we were. We took a lot more cuts in the administrative areas as opposed to the academic areas. We tried to figure out what were the most essential services that we needed to protect. We did not do furloughs. We did not cut any faculty positions. We did end up having to cut some staff positions that were in areas that were further out on the outer circles in order to make those cuts. But we were very careful and very deliberate about the kind of decisions that were made as a result. These are very difficult decisions to make, but they need to be discussed.
You mentioned grant funding during Yes. your presentation. Can you elaborate for us a little bit more on your thoughts and experiences regarding securing external grant funding as well as private donations that might help to offset some of the issues that we are facing as far as certain areas that have already received fairly significant reductions?
All right, so I mentioned that some of our more traditional sources of grant funding are now starting to dry up some. And so part of it is trying to figure out where where is the money at the federal level, at the state level? Are there areas that are switching where they're starting to give funding? And a lot of that has to do with making sure that you're making agency visits, that you are listening to them to find out where their interests are and making sure that you're connecting them with your faculty. So one of the things that I have done on a routine basis is I travel to Washington with our group. I visit with our congressional leaders to find out where they can help us with agencies, and I've been into agencies and talked to them about where their interests are, and I've connected them up with our faculty members. So that's a routine that I've typically done. We have an aviation program like you. I've been to the FAA and talked to them about what kinds of things we're doing that they might be interested in connecting with our faculty, and I've taken faculty members in to talk to them about their interests. So that's been part of my role. On the fundraising side, I've been very fortunate. Usually a provost isn't too active in fundraising. That has not been me. So one of the things that I do in the fall is I spend a lot of time in the president's box stewarding gifts. One of the most important gifts that we've had recently is a $105 million gift from the Osteopathic Heritage Foundation. I mentioned that campus in Dublin. Part of that campus in Dublin was funded by that gift. So the head of that foundation is someone that I have worked very closely with. I would say that that gift in a lot of ways looks a lot more like a grant than it does a gift, because there are very clear deliverables and there are matching pieces to that gift. So all of the matching pieces I had to approve and find the money for. So we have faculty matches, we have loans to the college to allow them to build certain things. There's a diabetes center there, there's a neuromuscular center there. And so all of those pieces were a part of my part of getting that gift. And we're about to go see him to ask him for a second gift in about a week. So.
Thank you. What process would you use to help the campus reevaluate SIU's mission and goals with an eye towards what the university might realistically look like in 5 or 10 years down the road? In essence, how do you create a long-term vision for campus in times like these?
So I read your strategic plan, and I would say that there's nothing to disagree with in your strategic plan, because everything is in your strategic plan. And I encountered pretty much the same thing when I came to Ohio University. We had what was called Vision Ohio, and the plan was about 100 pages long, and it had about 80 goals and probably about 150 metrics to measure. And one of my first jobs when I came to Ohio University is that the chair of the Board of Trustees said to me, I want a strategic plan that can be on a single piece of paper. And I thought, ooh, that's an interesting job. And he said, when I talk to people on campus and I ask them, what is the strategic plan for the university, nobody could really tell him. They could tell him some piece that resonated with them, but they really couldn't tell him what the strategic plan was. And the other problem with a strategic plan like that is that it had no priorities. What was most important in the plan? And one of the things that I notice about your plan is that you can't tell what the priorities are. And so while it's great, you know, there's a lot in there that's very admirable, I can't tell what the priorities are for this campus. So I would say my first job would be to try to have a discussion on campus to try to figure out, going forward, what are the most important priorities for the campus. Because you can't do everything, and especially in a constrained environment, you can't do everything. So what are the most important things to this campus moving forward? How do you focus on the things that are most critical? And when I start to talk about strengths today, you know, what I'm trying to do is to get a sense of, who are you? You know, what are the things that make you who you are? And how do you make those things the most important? Have I captured that? I would say when I came here, one of the things that would be most important is doing a listening tour. Coming around and talking to lots of groups and hearing you and trying to figure out who do you define yourself out? Who do you want to be going forward? I can't define that strategic plan. That's already in you. But we need to figure out going forward, how do we identify the most important things to focus on going forward? That would be the objective. Next.
Sorry. It's a long ways down there. Okay. What steps would you take to foster cooperation between campus units in order to eliminate the silo mentality that can exist when those units are competing for resources? And do you have specific examples of working in such scenarios?
Ah, that's my innovation strategy. So we also were really interested in trying to foster more collaboration across campus. And so this innovation strategy that we've put up is really aimed at trying to do interdisciplinary work. Disciplinary work is also very important, and our attempt was not to discontinue that, but we know that that work's going to continue whether or not we incentivize it or not. But how do you try to get more work across the boundaries of departments and across the boundaries of colleges? And so this innovation strategy that I talked about so briefly in my presentation was an attempt to try to do that. And one of the things that we were doing is that we started this with the deans, and we started talking to them about, are there particular areas where we have assets in your college, and you also have some assets in your college? And one of the things that we started to find out when we had that conversation is that they didn't even know that there were areas that were being researched in one college that also were being looked at in another. Let me give you a very specific example. In health and wellness, one of the areas that we came up with as a niche was the area of aging in place. You know, this is this area about, you know, people don't any longer really want to go to nursing homes. They want to stay in their own homes for as long as possible. And so we had faculty members in health sciences who were very interested in how do we give individuals the capacity from a health perspective to stay in their homes longer. We had individuals in engineering who were designing products that allowed them to figure out when people were less likely to fall. We had individuals in the arts area who were interested in providing individuals who were elderly with opportunities that stimulated their intellectual curiosity and their cultural curiosity in their homes. All of those people started coming together as a result of this process. And the deans would say, oh, I've got somebody interested in that. And another dean would say, I have somebody interested in that. And the other person said, have they talked to each other? And the answer typically was no. And so what we started to do is we started having workshops around these areas, and we started getting people and faculty together so that they started talking to each other. And then we put $5 million on the table annually for grants that would allow people to work together and put together proposals. And that got a lot of interest, as you might imagine. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things that we've tried to do, is to try to stimulate that kind of interdisciplinary work. And it's not, I will say, not just for research. It's also for curriculum, developing more interdisciplinary curriculum. And if you look at what are students interested in right now, they're interested in interdisciplinary work. If you look at what is getting funded now, it's more interdisciplinary work. So this is a wave of the future. We're trying to get there as well with the kind of thing that we're funding as well.
Thank you. What do you think the key to student success is at a university such as SIU? And how could you personally contribute to student success?
That is such a big question. There are so many things that are key to student success. It's engagement, it's retention, it's the good advisors, it's someone who cares about them and mentors them. There are so many components of making sure that a student is successful when they come to the university. It's making sure that we are thinking about what really makes a quality education. And it's little things. It's like, are they having a positive experience? And when they go to the registrar's office, are they having a good experience in the registrar's office? Or are they seeing that there are hurdles every time they try to get something done? All of those things count. So thinking about from when they walk in the door, when they first apply, all the way through their experience, and even when they're an alumni, all of that is a component of student success. And thinking about the entire system is really important to thinking about whether or not you have created an experience for students that allows them to have a successful experience at your university. So all those pieces count. And one of the things that I think is sometimes wrong is that people will sometimes say, that's not my job. But in fact, every single person who works at the university should think about student success being part of that job. Every single person. Because it is. They all impact whether or not students have a good experience at the university.
What do you see as the chancellor's role in boosting employee morale in an era of economic and financial uncertainty for the university, which includes concerns about job security and reduced benefits?
I think the chancellor has that role. I think other people have that role as well. But I think the chancellor's role is to be as honest as possible, to give information as soon as the chancellor has access to that information, to try to tell it like it is. One of the things that I think is difficult is that you don't want to scare people unnecessarily, but you want to give them the truth. You don't want to sugarcoat it either. So trying to balance that is always a constant challenge. But I think people need to know. They need to know what you know. And you need to provide them. But you also need to be providing leadership. So you're also saying, okay, here's the facts, but here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to work on solving that problem. Here's the steps we're taking. Here's how we're trying to address this issue. That's what leadership is. Not just, whew, we've thrown up our hands and we don't know what to do now. You can't do that. You need to be having ways that you are trying to address that issue. I mean, one of the things that I really like about the president is that he is making the argument nonstop about the value of higher education. And there are great arguments to make about economic impact, about the impact that you have on your students. That's the role of both the president and the role of the chancellor, to constantly be making that argument and to be thinking about, okay, if there are going to be cuts, how do we make those cuts so that they have the least impact on our students and on our core? That's the role of the chancellor. Let's show leadership now.
Well, speaking of solving problems, you noted our attention to enrollment and retention matters.
Yes.
What would you view as the critical areas for achieving success in these areas, and are there things that we could do to improve our process?
So I noticed that enrollment numbers are looking stronger. This is good, and that you have a retention plan, also very good, but there's more that can be done on both fronts. These are critical. In a situation now where you are tuition-driven, enrollment ends up being very key. And if you cannot keep students at a higher level, it's also very important. Now, I'm really impressed by the increase in retention that you achieved. But it also can be higher. And so I think about the kinds of strategies that I have seen work and the best practices and the high-impact practices and assessing whether or not every practice that you put in place has the outcome that you want. Those are the kinds of things that I think you want to think about. So let me talk a little bit about some of the successes in terms of enrollment. Mira noticed that I had really good successes in terms of enrollment. So when I first came to the university, and in the six-year period, we increased our applications by 46%. We increased our enrollments by 26% over that six-year period. But how did we do it? How do we manage to increase our enrollment? Because I will tell you that in the state of Ohio, there are other universities, which I will not name by name, that are decreasing. They are losing enrollments, but we are not. So how in the state of Ohio are we managing to increase our enrollment when our sister institutions are not having the same luck? Because I'll tell you, they're trying to figure it out too. So here are some things that are going on. One of the things we did is we did a very thorough five-year enrollment plan, and we are working that plan. And that plan includes targets for all of our different sectors. So what are we trying to do in terms of transfer students? What are we trying to do in terms of community college students? What are we trying to do in terms of out-of-state students? What are we trying to do in terms of our in-state and our out-of-state population? And we have a plan for each one of those constituencies. How are we trying to accomplish that? One of the things that we did, let me talk about community college partnerships as one example. So it's one thing to have an MOU with a community college that says that we'll have a good relationship with you and you'll send us students. What we did is we put relationship managers on the community colleges. They're actually physically present on the community colleges so that they feel like that person is part of their staff. And that person works with those students, and those students, when they are at the community college, already feel like they are an Ohio University student. We give them the garb. We give them all the trinkets. They are already ready to come to Ohio University when they are at the community college. So we have a very good success rate in getting those community colleges. We have 19 community college partners, and we have relationship managers on those community colleges. It makes a huge difference. And they like us compared to other institutions in the state that have community college MOUs who do not pay them nearly as much attention. So there's a different way in which you can work that relationship to make it work in a much more effective way. Another thing we've done is that we recruit students earlier and earlier and earlier than ever before. Take advantage of every time they step foot on your campus. Make sure that you are seeing that as a recruitment possibility. You can't wait for them to come to you anymore. This is a very competitive environment. One of the things that we've done is we completely restructured our scholarship program. And now we use data analytics to try to figure out what will it take to yield a particular student. And we're much more successful at yielding that student now. And all of this is just enrollment before we even start to talk about retention. So the professional advisors is one of our strategies on retention. How do we figure out when a student is at risk and is showing a possibility that they may drop away? How do we make sure that we're doing an early intervention to try to make sure that we're getting to that student before they're thinking about leaving us? Why are they leaving? What are all the various reasons why they leave? And what interventions do we have for each of the reasons why a student might leave? All of those things can be done even more intensively. You're on the right track, but even more intensively than you're doing now.
Thank you. There is a unique relationship between SIU and the city of Carbondale and SIU and the broader region. What types of strategies have you been involved with elsewhere that you might consider employing here to enhance the university's relationship with the city and our region?
So universities are no longer silos. They no longer operate all by themselves. They have to operate within their community. I read the economic impact study, and it's clear that you have a huge economic impact on your city and on your region. One of the things that I learned as I was riding around yesterday with Pam Schilling is that the city wants very much to be a partner with the university. And that's wonderful, because sometimes there's a strained relationship between the city and the university. So there are lots of opportunities to think about places where you can partner, places where you can have possibilities where you can do things that will benefit both of you, different kinds of activities where you can do things that could benefit. So I think part of it is sitting down and talking about where there are good collaborations where you can work together. We've done that in Athens. I meet with the mayor. We have some good projects in terms of cleaning up the city, and the students come out and do service projects with the city. One of the places where we have a very good collaboration is around Halloween. I understand you've had a Halloween project too, that Halloween. we still have Halloween going in a fairly big way, and one of the things that we do is that the city comes out and the university comes out and we patrol the streets. I patrol the streets on Halloween night along with city officials, and together our Athens Police Department and our OU Police Department and a lot of our staff are out. We wear our green jackets. We have green and white as our color, and we wear our green jackets, and I've got a walkie-talkie, and I'm calling in when I see something that should not be happening to let them know that they need to get down to Court Street and help me. So we do a lot of that kind of activity with the city as well. And so we're talking about when there are fests, we work together to try to handle those kinds of issues. And not only in Athens, but also in Dublin. When we were doing the campus in Dublin, I gave the presentation to the city council about the vision for the university in the city before they gave us the gift of the 90 acres. So a lot of relationships between the city and the university.
Thank you. Thank you. Would you please describe your experience in working with doctoral students and programs, and in doing so, how vital do you feel they are to the university, to a university like SIU Carbondale? In your answer, please address your thoughts on the importance of funding for graduate students at all levels and funding for the graduate school in general.
Okay, this is an easy one because I was a graduate dean. So when I was a faculty member, I had several graduate students of my own, several doctoral students that I mentored through to their PhDs. And I was also graduate dean, where I was responsible for all of the graduate programs at the University of Missouri, including the joint programs with the professional schools, the medical school and the law school. So I frequently helped graduate students in programs across the university. And when I was associate dean, I was responsible for running and helping to get funding for IGERTS, for NSF programs, running minority programs, all those kinds of programs at the university. I administered all the fellowship programs for graduate students in the university. So I do think that doctoral programs are very important. I think finding funding for graduate students is very important. They're sometimes harder to get funding for from donors. But one of the things that we started when I was at the University of Missouri is that I made the argument that we needed our own development officer. And I could not convince our advancement office that they should fund it. So I funded it out of my own budget to prove to them that we could raise money, which we did. And part of what we did is I had a program where I asked former graduate students who had been funded on fellowships to fund a credit hour for another graduate student. And we were quite successful in raising some money for other graduate students. So very important to try to fund graduate students to continue their education as well.
Thank you. Would you please tell us something about yourself that you feel provides you a unique advantage to your ability to succeed as Chancellor of Southern Illinois University, Carbondale?
I'm a mediator. So when I was at the University of Missouri, we have a law school, and they have a Center for Dispute Resolution, and they train judges and lawyers to be mediators, and I asked to come through that training. And so I am certified as a mediator, and I use that all the time. I use it pretty much every day now. Those skills are very important. I don't go in and do it officially anymore, but I do it informally pretty regularly now. So it's a very useful set of skills to have.